Okay, so we are holding on Kufyud Beys, Omud Beys, the third line from the top. We talked yesterday about the question of if a, where it says, where the Torah tells us that a daughter can inherit from her father and from her mother, as the case may be, and at the end of Parashas, at the end of Parashas Maaseh, at the end of Chumash Bamidbar, the Torah tells us about the problem that Bnei Menashe brought up, that if a girl like that marries into another Shevet, the Nachla is going to pass out of that Shevet. And what should be done about that? And Moshe Rabbeinu tells them that Hashem says that indeed a woman in that situation has to marry within her own Shevet. Well, again, we'll learn later in the parak if that only applied in that generation. Yeah, we have to.
She cannot marry out.
That's the point, right. Well, she's of Nachla, right. So we talked yesterday about those two possibilities, how the Nachla might go away, might pass out of her father's Shevet into another Shevet. Either if she passes away without any children and her husband yarshins her, if we say that a husband yarshins his wife, Midar Aisa, which itself was...
She had brothers. And then she was allowed to marry out of her Shevet.
Right, right.
And
right.
Then she passed away.
And then she passed away.
And
right.
then her
husband Yarshim. So but even if she didn't have brothers to begin with, the Torah wants that she shouldn't marry out of her Shevet because then the Nachla is going to go out of her Shevet. That would be Hasava Sabal. That would
well,
be
so
the,
how is she allowed to?
She's not allowed to, that's the point. But the reason why the Torah wants her to marry within her Shevet is to prevent the Nachla from going out of her Shevet. If she's already married to, if she had brothers and they passed away, fine, that can't be helped. You're not going to make her divorce her husband because of that.
The Torah could have made a decree that even if she marries out, the Nachla is going to stay in
her. But it doesn't, because how is it going to? It's either going to go to her husband, if we say that the husband inherits her, or it's going to go to her children, one way or the other. There's no getting around that. So, it's one thing if she had brothers, she married legitimately out of the Shevet, and then the brothers passed away, and all of a sudden she finds herself an heiress. Fine, you're not going to make her divorce her husband from another Shevet. But at least if she is, to begin with, going to be an heiress, she's an only child, or she has only sisters, like B'nai Slafud, then you want her to marry within her Shevet.
Right.
Because there's two possible problems. There's a Hasava Sabal, there's that the Nachla will go to her husband when she passes away, or there's Hasava Sabdain, that she'll have they'll have children and the Nachla will go to those children. So we talked yesterday.
The children will be out of the Shevet.
And the children are out of the Shevet also, right. So we talked yesterday, the Gemara started talking yesterday about those two issues, Hasava Sabal versus Hasava Sabdain. And by the way, I mean, you might well ask, so what's the difference? I mean, one way or the other, you're going to have both. But so the one answer is, let's say the woman is infertile. Let's say she's not able to have children. Hasava Sabain isn't going to be a problem, but Hasava Sabal could still be a problem if you hold that the husband yarshins her. You could have the other way around. You could have, we learned back in Ksubas, that conceivably, at least according to some opinions, a husband can declare that he doesn't have any further interest in his wife's nechassim. According to the opinion that he can even override his ability to yarshin her with that, which is a machlokes on that, but if we say he can, then there you have. There can be a situation, there's no Hasava Sabal, but there could be Hasava Sabain if they have children. So yeah. Okay, We brought various limudim, how we know that a husband yarshins his wife, and in that connection we talked about this whole matter of Hasava Sabain or Hasava Sabal. Which one is the Torah concerned about, or which one is the Torah more concerned about? That it'll pass out of her Shevet by going to her husband, or that it'll pass out of her Shevet by going to her children?
Well,
so now we're going
to more of a concern for one.
Well, what is the pasuk talking about? We said yesterday we wanted to say that maybe the pasuk we wanted to say yesterday that even though there are three psukim on that, maybe the Torah is only concerned about Hasava Sabain. Maybe Hasava Sabal isn't a concern because midat Torah the husband doesn't yarshin his wife. And why did we have three psukim? We said maybe to establish there's an efe and two loisa that's involved if she marries out of her shape. So now we're going to continue on that topic. Which one is the Torah telling us we don't want to have? So Tanya Basibas Abain Batanya Basibas Abal. We learn Brises that say that Psukim are referring to Sibas Abain, that the Nachla will go out of her Shevet and go to her son's Shevet. Batanya Basibas Abal, and we learn a Brisa that mentions that the concern is Sibas Abal. Now the Rashbam says the Rashbam's girsa over here is that which is the girsa that we have in front of us in the Gemara, is that not necessarily are these two Brises arguing. They're both going to end up saying that some of the psukim are talking about one and some are talking about the other. Tosfos brings a different gear, so that actually we're going to have the two braises are in fact arguing. One of them holds that the psukim are referring to Siva Saben, and the other one would hold that it's referring only to, that it's referring to Siva Sabal. Tosfos says that the two braises are arguing, that Ashbam learns they're not necessarily arguing. They're just coming at it from a different angle, but they come up with the same conclusion.
Okay.
So, Tanya v'Siva Saben, we learn a braise that says that the psukim are talking about Siva Saben. The psukim are talking about the problem where the Nachla is going to go from her shevet, or rather from her father's shevet, whatever, to her son's shevet. As follows. So the pasuk says. So again, we have to refer back to the Chumash over here, because there are three psukim. There are a few psukim that we're going to be concerned with over here. Let's review quickly what the psukim say over there. So, Bnei Menashe come with their problem. What's going to happen with Bnei Tzlochot if they marry after Shevet? So Moshe says, this is what Hashem said as follows. They should marry within their own Shevet. So Nachla should not pass out from Bnei Yisrael from one Shevet to another. Because each person should among the Jewish people should stick to the Nachla of their fathers. Then the next pasuk continues, any daughter that inherits Nachla from the Shvatim of Bnei Yisrael, and we said the other day, Matos can include the case where she herself darshins from both Shvatim, because she has a father from one Shevet and a mother from another. She has to marry somebody from the Shevet of her father, and we talked about yesterday, Abaya might hold that it has to also be that her husband would have a mother from the Shevet of her mother as well. Laman Yushu Bnei Yisrael, Ishnachat Avoysev, in order that Bnei Israel will each inherit the Nachla of their fathers. Then the third pasuk says, "V'leisitiv Nachla mimata l'mata acher." Nachla should not be exchanged from one shevet to another. Ki ishva Nachalosi yidbuku matas bnei Israel. Each person in their Nachla, the shvatim of bnei Israel, should stick to. Those are the three psukim that we're going to be dealing with.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there's a lot of repetition.
Yeah. So the third one.
Yeah. So when the pasuk says, "V'leisitiv Nachla bnei Israel mimata l'mata," which is the first pasuk. The Siva Sabena Pasuk Medaber. This first Braisa says that Pasuk is talking about the problem that it'll go via the son, that it's going to be inherited by the son and wind up in another shape. We'll see soon how the Braisa knows that it's talking about Siva Sabena and not Siva Sabal. So you're going to argue, maybe not. Maybe that pasuk is referring to the problem that the husband is going to yarshin her. No, true. But then when you have two psukim later, the third pasuk that says that nachla should not pass from one shevet to another shevet, that is talking about the problem of her husband yarshining her and going out of her shevet that way. How do we understand the first pasuk Zion, v'siva sabena pasuk medaber, that it's talking about the sun, yarshining. So according to this first braisa, in other words, the middle pasuk we're leaving out of the picture for now. The middle pasuk is saying we said yesterday mitzvah saseh, that she should marry within her own shevet. We're not getting into that, but the two psukim that bracket it, both of which say, that Nachla should not be passing from one Mata to another, we're saying that the first one refers to the son, and the second one, which is the last of the three psukim, refers to the husband. Again, we're going to discuss in the Gemara soon how this Braita knows that. Why can't it be the other way around?
Yes.
It could, but well, we're going to see from the Gemara soon that it can't. We're going to see why. Okay. Tanya Edoch, then we learn another Braita. That goes at it kind of the other way around. It still comes to the same conclusion, but it gives the psukim in reverse order. But when the pasuk says v'leisisiv nachla mimata l'mata acher, when it says that nachla should not pass from one shevet to another shevet, and we're going to see soon, only that last pasuk mentions the word acher, another. That's going to be significant. We're going to see soon.
Acher
means another. But the first pasuk Zayin, just says, "V'leisisiv nachla mimata l'mata acher." It shouldn't go from one shevet to another, from shevet to shevet. Only the last pasuk says that it shouldn't go from mata to mata acher, to another shevet. We're going to see soon that that's significant. But this second braisa starts by going with that last pasuk. That one is talking specifically about the husband yarshining. And after Oyma Vasiva Sabala in Ella Vasiva Sabain, so you're saying it refers to the problem of the husband Yashining. Maybe it refers to the problem of the son Yashining and it's going out of the shape that way. When you have two psukim earlier, when it just says the word that it shouldn't go from one shavit to from shavit to shavit, Hareya Siva Sabain Om. That's referring to the son.
Well, where do we know that from?
That's what we're going to get to. Well, the point is, in other words, the point of the Rashbam, again, the two Brises are not arguing. The only difference between the two Brises is the first Brise that takes it as a given, that Pasuk Zion, V'loisisiv Nachlon, Masa V'Masa means, the first Brise that takes it as a given that the last Pasuk refers to the husband, for reasons which we're going to discuss soon. Therefore, by elimination, the first Pasuk must be referring to the son. The second Brise that takes it the other way around, that it's a given that the first Pasuk is talking about the son. Therefore, by elimination, the last Pasuk must be talking about the husband. Again, according to the Rashbam, there's no real argument between the two Brises. They're both saying the same thing, just coming at it from different angles. Just coming from starting with different psukim and different
assumptions.
It's called Mashmos Doshin Ikabinayim. It's called the only argument is which one is it obvious means such and such, and which one is it less obvious that we have to deduce by elimination. Again, according to Tosfos, it's not like that. According to Tosfos' Gersa, the two Brises are actually arguing. That one is saying that the Torah is only worried about Sivas Habal, and the other one is saying that the Torah is only worried about Sivas Habal.
In both?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
In one Brise, it's only Sivas Habal, and in the other Brise, it's only Sivas Habal.
Isn't that what we say?
No, according to the Rashbam and Gersa, which is what we have in front of us, both Brises agree that Sivas Habal or Sivas Habain are both problems which the Torah wants to address. One in Pasuk Zion, one in Pasuk Tes. The question is, and not only that, both Brises, according to the Rashbam, are taking it as a given that Pasuk Zion, which does not mention the word Acher, is talking about the son, and Pasuk Tes, which says Acher, is talking about the husband. They're just starting from different assumptions. The first Brisa assumes that the pasuk that mentions Acher must be talking about the husband. Therefore, by elimination, the other one has to be talking about the son. And the second Brisa takes it the other way around. The one that is not mentioning Acher must be talking about the son. And therefore, by elimination, the one that says Acher must be talking about the husband. Again, according to the Rashbam, there's no actual argument between them. According to Tosfos, there is. But no, when you have the earlier pasuk that says that Nachla shouldn't pass from Shevet to Shevet, that's referring to it being moved around from one child through the child, that the child inherits it, that the son inherits it. So what are we doing with the pasuk that mentions the word Acher? That is talking about the husband. That's talking about the problem of the husband, Yarshini. Okay. Fine, so those are the two braises. Now, Dekulei Alma Mias Mimatala Mata Acha B'Sivas Habal Akos B'Davar. Well, the bottom line is both Brises agree that the Pasuk that says Acher, Pasuk Tes, which says Mimatala Mata Acher, is referring to the thing of the husband, Yashini. My Mashma, where are you getting that? Where are you getting that? According to the Rashbam explains, the question is according to the first Brisa. The first Brisa assumes that a child, a son, is closer to his mother, is a closer relative to the mother than his father, than her husband. So therefore, so he would say, in other words, that if you have the first Pasuk must be, if you're talking about the first Pasuk, therefore must be referring to the son Yashining, then, because it's more logical to say, if you have to figure what would the Pasuk be talking about first, probably the more logical thing. It's more logical that a son inherits from his mother than that a husband inherits from his wife. Because after all, the mother of the son is more closely related to the mother. That's the question. According to that first Tana, what is the Tana of the first Braita saying? He's saying, you have the first Pasuk. You don't know whether it's referring to the son or the husband. Since you have the second pasuk that mentions the word acher, that refers to the husband, therefore, by elimination, the first pasuk must be referring to the son. Why? Who says it has to be that way? Maybe it could be... It could be the other way around, or maybe both of them, or maybe like Tosfos said, maybe both of them are talking about Sivas Habain, or maybe neither one is talking about Sivas Habal at all.
What could be acher?
That's what we're going to see in a minute, what the significance of Acher is. We don't know yet what the significance of Acher is. That's what we have to figure out. Okay. So, Simon. Now, usually when the Gemara says Simon, it usually means there's going to be a Simon for a list of words or letters or whatever that are simonim for the next thing that the Gemara is mentioning over here. Here you don't have that. So some of the Mephoshim say that actually Simon over here is actually the name of an Amora. Simon Omer Rabba Bar Rav Shila, that Simon, that was his name, said in the name of Rabba Bar Rav Shila, such and such, as we're going to say. The other possibility, some of the Mephoshim say, is that maybe there was supposed to be a word over here after the word Simon, but it got left out from the state.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
You said that there was one name that appears nowhere else. In
not in Nezikin, but in each Masechta, yes, you have one. But we already had that. We already had that earlier in Amos. In each Masechta, that's what the Rav Chava said. But when the four Yerushalmi Kodshim came out. But we don't need that over here. We already have Rav about Sharshum in an earlier parak.
You
have at least one. Yeah.
So it could be
that it means Simon, or it could be that Simon was his name, or it could mean there was supposed to be a Simon over here. Initials of the next words that the Gemara is going to bring: Ish, Yidbaku, Matos, and Acher. And then the Simon would have been something like Imer or Imar or whatever, and it might have been left out by mistake. Okay. Anyway. Omer Rav Bar Shitzos, Omer Rav Bar Shila, or Simon Omer Rav Bar Shila. No, it's like this: Omer Kro Ish, because you know that the second pasuk must be talking about the husband, because it mentions the word Ish. It says Ish Benachalosa Yibuku, that they have to stick to that. Each person has to stick to their nachal. The word Ish, besides meaning of a man, what?
Maybe Omer
or Imer, yeah.
Yeah.
No, because you have to have that
word twice.
Yeah, that they may have left one out, exactly. Well, not really Omar, because you have a Yud in there. You'd have to have a Yud in there because you have the word Yidbuku, but it could have been Imer.
Okay.
It could have been Imer or something.
Okay.
Yeah,
it was very,
yeah.
This one would
yeah.
be good if you get
yeah.
rid of it because it's definitely a mistake.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Okay. So the first, the second pasuk says the word Ish. And the word Ish, besides meaning a man, can also mean a husband. So in other words, the pasuk is telling us Ish v'nachalosa, that each husband, what? Ish can mean a man, but it can also mean a husband. For example, Ish nami. It can, but it can also mean a husband. Ish nami, for example, the Rashbam. In other words, that this is the second pasuk is saying you don't want it to go from shevet to shevet, because Ish v'nachalosa yidbiku matas b'nei Israel. You want the husband should stick to his nachla and not to the nachla of another shevet. Okay. The problem with that is, both Pasuk Zion and Pasuk Tes have the word Ish in them. Now, that brings up the question, so what? The Machshon didn't know that. So this is where we get into the question of how familiar were the Amoraim with Pesukim? So the Rashbam, which I mentioned on the WhatsApp. So the Rashbam says, of course, both the Machshon and the Mataritz know that it says Ish in both Pesukim. You could open up a Chumash and see that it says Ish. But we thought to say that maybe, okay, you have Ish in Pasuk Zayin, fine, but maybe that's used for some other drasha. So you have the Ish in the second Pasuk to mean a husband. The problem with that is, fine, but if you have the word Ish in both Sukkim, how do you know the first one is for a drasha and the second one means a husband? Maybe the other way around. Maybe the first one means a husband and the second one is for a drasha. That's the Rashbam's point of view. Tosfos, on the other hand, says, so you look on the first line of Tosfos, Pa'amim shalayhoi b'pien b'psukim. There were times when Amoraim were not so familiar with psukim. And he brings from a Gemara and Bava Kama also, where at least the surface meaning of the Gemara over there is that one of the Amoraim over there isn't familiar with a pasuk. So
I think there's a story somewhere later on about Nach. A lot of the Amoraim weren't familiar with Nach. There was a story that someone was questioned by either the Reish Galus or someone in the government.
Think I know what you're talking about. You're talking about in Sanhedrin where it talks about over there Mitzvah Kvurim and Atzeret Minayin. No, but that's not Atzeret. That's not from Nach. I don't know. No, but at least to know it, though.
And then they say a lot of the Amoraim didn't know.
Okay, so Tosfos takes the view that yes, you could well have the Amoraim were not necessarily so familiar with Pesukim.
Wow.
And actually,
not
Bakim. Yeah, in other words, not so Baki. In other words, yeah, they might have to look it up. So there's a great deal of discussion going all the way back to the time of the Goyim. Is that in fact the case? Is it in fact the case that there could have been Amoraim who were not so Baki? Tosfos says on the basis of this, because Tosfos says if you take the Gemara here at face value, it sounds like it sounds like Rav Bar Rav Shila is saying because the pasuk is Ish, implying it sounds like he didn't know the other pasuk also says Ish.
Say it, then and the Kosos can for sure say it.
Right. So no. So the Goyim say the Goyim say that no, it doesn't mean they weren't familiar with the Psukim.
Oh.
It means that similar to what the Rashbam says, that they had a different understanding maybe of what the Pasuk is saying or whatever, but not they didn't necessarily know the Pasuk. And there's others.
The Rishonim, the Goyim don't say it was because they were not Bakim. I think
Tosfos can't. It's so much. Tosfos can argue with the Goyim.
No, that's not the point. The point is Tosfos knows
in their own way. Tosfos and the Goyim are independent of each other. It doesn't matter. It's a couple hundred years, but it doesn't matter. Their tradition of how they learned Gemara is not necessarily dependent on that of the Goyim. You find all the time where they're showing them all with the Goyim. All right. Anyway, I was going to say. You have now, on the other hand, for example, you have the Chidah says also, how is it possible? I mean, we know the Rashi over there in Parshas Kisisa that says that just like a kala is decorated with 24 ornaments, so a Talmud Chacham has to be Baki in the 24 Sfarim of Tanakh. So what do you mean? How are you talking that they don't know a Pasuk? And yet, on the other hand, on the third hand at this point, we are by now, you have the Alter Rebbe says in Hilchos Talmud Torah, bringing from the Rambam, that to begin with, it has to be that a person starts out by learning, you have to, one part, a section of your day you're learning Mikra, a section of your day you're learning Mishnah, a section of your day you're learning Gemara, but eventually there comes a point, once you advance to learning Gemara, that you're spending pretty much all your time on learning Gemara, and maybe once in a while you review, and Adrabba, he uses the expression that the Alter Rebbe says over there, that you have to review, what the expression says over there, you have to review Gemara, kifle kiflayim, more than Tanakh, and he refers over there in the Ma'ariv HaKremes over there. He refers to the same Gemara and Bava Kamma that Tosfos is referring to over here, which means, in other words, according to the Alter Rebbe, yes, it's possible once you have the Amoraim are already learning, they're obviously learning Gemara. That's what makes them Amoraim. They're occasionally maybe reviewing the Psukim, but not enough necessarily to prevent them from getting it. So there is a lot of discussion back and forth on that question. Whether I'll tell you also, by the way, as a side thing. It's interesting, we find it's not so clear also that you find also with the Rambam, it's not so clear that he was 100% Baki in Psukim. First of all, you find in quite a number of places where the Rambam quotes a Pasuk in Yad HaZaka, and it's not the actual wording of the Pasuk as it is in Tanakh. You even find a place
in
Hilchos.
Did the Rambam write in Sefer in Hebrew?
Yeah, he wrote it in Hebrew. Okay. You even find a place in Hilchos Tzedakah where the Rambam quotes.
Mishnah Torah was written
in Hebrew. Yeah, all those other Sforim were written in Arabic, but the Mishnah Torah was written in Hebrew. Yeah, but you find a place in Hilchos Tzedakah, in Hilchos Matnasanim, whatever, where he says Kemoshe Ne, Kemoshe Kosu, as it says in the pasuk, Shava Sanim Apatishna. That's not a pasuk. That's from the Nusach Hatzfila and then Nusach Tzard that they have towards the end of Nishma. There's something also. I saw a while back a reference at the end of the Rambam at the end of Pirush Mishnayot, the Masechta Zvachim, the Mishnayot over there in Zvachim and the Gemara over there discussed the history of where the Mishkan was until the Beit HaMikdash was built, when you were and weren't allowed to build Bamos, and then it says eventually the Beit HaMikdash was built in Yerushalayim, and from then on that's the only Makom Shechina, and you're never allowed to build Bamos anywhere else. In that connection, that I'm bringing in Pirush Mishnayos, the fact that we have three psukim together, Ki Vacha Hashem Vati and Evil Amoshe Boy, Ki Yaakov Vacha Lo Yudke Yisrael the Skulazai, Ki Lo Yitesh Hashem Es Amai V'Nachalot Lo Yazai, and he explains how those three psukim go together and teach us, just like the Abish that chose the Jewish people eternally, so he chose Yerushalayim eternally. Except that Ashash points out, those three psukim are together in Yehich Loi. They're not together in Chilim. One's from Kapitul Kuf Lamed Beis, one's from Kapitul Kuf Lamed Hei, one's from Kapitul Tzadik Dalet. They're nowhere near each other.
They're
all in Tillim. Because if you say they're together, then you could say, the David HaMelech put them all together in order to express this idea that the choice of Yerushalayim is permanent, just like the choice of Jewish people is permanent. But if they're not together in Tillim, they're only together in Yehich Vayid, laughed at me, you can douse it like that. Maybe, but it's a shvacha thing to say. So at least on the surface, it seems that, yeah. Okay.
Maybe the Chatzila is old enough that it's just like stupid.
Maybe, but again, that's a bit of a stretch to say. I don't know how far back Yehich Vayid goes.
So we don't have any answers for you anymore.
So we don't have, yeah. So it's not certain. You could say, like Tosfos over here, that yes, sometimes they weren't familiar with Sukkim. And you could say, like the other answers, that no, they were, just use like the Rashbam's answer, or like there's a different answer in connection with the Gemara and Bava Kamma, but there's a different explanation what he means when he says over there that you're asking me why it doesn't say a test in the Luchos Rishonis, ask whether there's a test in the Luchos Rishonis, because I'm not familiar. So there's various explanations over there that he doesn't literally mean he's not familiar. He means he's not familiar with the reason behind it or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then this was started, was by the
that's the basic Nusach HaTfilah, like Shemana Esrei. We don't know the full name of Yehi
Shloi.
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
Therefore, it would have
maybe. It's possible, but I don't know. Okay, onward. All right, let's go on. Okay, so the question is, so again, Rabbi Bar Avshila is saying the reason why the Tana of the first Braisa knew that the second Pasuk over there, Pasuk Tes, is referring to the Hasevet, the Baal, is referring to the husband, is because it says the word Ish. The question is, the first Pasuk also said Ish. El Amr of Nachmei, Tzok Amakur Yidbeku. Okay, Rav Nachmei says, here's another answer. The second Pasuk mentions the word Yidbeku. They should stick. And Yidbeku also is something that would refer to husband and wife. The Davak B'Ishto. So therefore, the second pasuk has to be referring to the husband. Again, the problem is Tavai Yidbuku. Yidbuku literally means they should stick, like they should stick to their own
husband. Either one.
No, because Yidbuku is something that would refer more to the husband.
Why?
Because you don't find that the son has a Yidbak with his mother, but you find that the husband has a Yidbak with his wife. The Davak B'Ishtei. Okay, the problem is, again, Tavai Yidbuku Ksidku. Again, the problem is it says Yidbuku in both stories. Elo Amarava Amakro Yidbuku Matan. Okay, but Rava says yes, but the second pasuk mentions that both psukim say the word yidbuku. It is true, but the first one just says yidbuku bnei Yisrael. The second one he says yidbuku matas bnei Yisrael. That means, in other words, you're talking the kind of zika that comes between two matas, namely between the husband when a husband from one shevet marries a wife from another shevet, and you have a bedavak beishtoi over there. So therefore, that's what made the Tana of the first Braita say that we must be talking about the husband, Yarshining, over there. Because otherwise the word Yidbeku Matos wouldn't fit to a case where you have a mother from one Shevet and a son from another Shevet. True, you have Yidbeku in both places. Of necessity, you have to say the Yidbeku in the earlier Pasuk is not referring to the relationship between husband and wife. But at least when you have Yidbeku Matos, that implies the kind of Zika that comes through a marriage.
Can we take a picture of the hand?
Sure.
Okay.
Can
we want to
take
a picture? Can we do it afterwards?
Okay. All right.
Well, then everyone's going to leave.
Yeah. Okay.
No, nobody's
going to
take a picture.
It's fine. It's fine. Does it? Yeah. Rav Ashi Omar. Rav Ashi says a different answer. Omar Kro. Okay. The Yidbak is Meloshin, it means marriage.
Right.
So therefore, yes, we have both Sukkim say the word Yidbaku, it is true, but the second one mentions it in connection with the word Matos. How do you have a dvika between matos? How do you have a connection between matos when a husband and wife get married and you have a vadovak v'ishtoi that he joins together with his wife? So therefore, it's logical to say that the Tana of the first Braisa understood that must be talking about the marriage between a husband from one Shevet and a wife from another Shevet.
So it talks about the husband.
So it's talking about the husband, and therefore that answers the question how we know the Tana of the first Braisa knew that the last of the three psukim is talking about Hasavas HaBaal, talking about the problem of the husband yarshining from his wife.
It's not Ish and Yidbuku together.
It's not Ish. Forget about Ish and forget about Yidbuku. We're leaving out Ish. We're saying the fact that it says Yidbuku together with the word Matos. That's Rava's answer. Rav Ashi Yomar. Rav Ashi says a different answer. Omar Kromi Matel Mate Acher. Rav Ashi says you also have the second pasuk mentions the word Acher, another shevet. Or Ben Lav Acher. Now a son is not an Acher. A son is more closely connected with his mother. Just like we say, Bro Kara Davua. So also Bro is Kara Deime. A son is a limb of his mother and his father. So therefore, you can't say. So therefore, when the husband, when the son yarshins, you can't call it that it's acher. You can't call it he's another one. Whereas when the husband yarshins first, I mean, the husband and the wife are not biologically related. So therefore, that can be more called acher. So on the basis of that, either that it says yidbeku matas, or on the fact that it says mi matal mata acher, either of those proves what we set out to prove, that the Tana of the first Braisa knows, therefore, that pasuk is referring to the husband yarshining from his wife.
Acher would be what, the husband?
Acher would mean another, meaning the husband, who's from another shevet than his wife. The son is also from another shevet, of course, but the son can be less considered acher. You find that in other connections also, by the way. You find, we've talked many times about the matter of Sdei Ahuza, that you a field that you donated to Hektish, and then you bought it back, or your son bought it back. How do we know, Taka, that if the son buys it back, it doesn't go to the Kohanim? Because the Pasuk says that if the Gizbar sold the field, Le'ish Acher. Again, Acher means not a son, because a son is not an Acher, a son is not another. Alderach, you know, it's like the famous thing that Eber used to explain about the Yosef Hashem Li Bein Acher, that the special quality that Yosef has to turn an Acher into a Bein, to turn somebody who's another, who's separate, who's ostensibly separate from the Eberster, and turn him into a Bein, turn him into a son of the Eberster. So you see that Acher means not a son. Okay. All right. So therefore, so that answers the question. That's how the Tana of the first Braisa knew that the pasuk that the last pasuk over there, Leisisiv Nachla Mimachla Mata Acher Ki Ish Benachalosa Yidbiku Matos Bnei Yisrael. That's how we know, either from the Acher or from the Yidbiku Matos, that it's referring to the husband. And if that's referring to the husband, by elimination, the other pasuk must be referring to the son. And then the second Braisa goes at it the other way, that the first pasuk of necessity is referring to the son, and how do we know the second pasuk is referring to the husband? Okay. Fine. Okay, another din in this connection. Amar Rav Abba, Amar Rav Yochanan, Amar Rav Yanai, Amar Rebbe, Umotu b'mishmei de Rav Yeshua ben Torcha. So we have this chain, Rav Abba, who said in the name of Rav Yochanan, who said in the name of Rav Yanai, who said in the name of Rebbe, but some want to say that the first link in the chain over there is not Rebbe, but rather Rav Yeshua ben Torcha. And before we get into what they actually say, so who was Rabbi Shulchan Kolach? Tosfos brings that in over here, and that's where we get into Rabbi Akiva. Tosfos starts saying like this. I mean, who is Korcha? It's a bit of an unusual name. Tosfos brings from the Ri, and actually Rashi himself says it in a couple of places also, that Korcha is none other than Rabbi Akiva.
Really?
Why is he called Korcha? Because you have a Gemara in Bechorus, where Ben Azai says that all the Chachmei Yisrael are in front of me like klipas hashum, they're like a garlic peel, they're like nothing, except for this bald one, except for Akireya Hazeh. And who is that Akireya Hazeh? Is Rabbi Akiva. So if Rabbi Akiva is Kereach, if he's bald, then his son, and we actually find a Gemara in Shavuos that says that Rabbi Akiva had a son named Rabbi Yeshua, then that's him, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. That's what Rashi says and elsewhere, and that's what the Ri says over here in Tosfos. So Rabbi Natan says that can't be. I mean, first of all, it would be disparaging him. First of all, because one time in all of Shas he's called bald, therefore you're forever after going to call his son Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha.
Before he got bald, what did they call him?
Well, that's it. No, but before he got bald, not necessarily was when he, remember, he only started learning Torah at age 40. He may have been going bald by then. But anyway, also, but to call him bald is a gnai to him. Also, Tosfos points out it doesn't work chronologically because it follows. Tosfos says, there's a Gemara in Megillah. There's one in Megillah that tells us that before Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha passed away, Rebbe wanted him to bench him. And he asked Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, how is it you lived so long? By Meher after Yomim, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha tells him the schutzim that he had, and Rebbe asked him, give me a bracha. So Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha says, Yehirachin, you should live half as long as I do. So, no, it means because, in other words, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha lived to an old age. But Tosfos says, let's make the calculation.
I shouldn't be the same age.
Okay, so actually Rebbe himself asks that over there, and Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha tells him, look, you know, you got to leave room for your successors. You know, ultimately your successors have to take over the Nasirs.
So
know,
they can take after the
No, but if he outlives them, you know, I mean, Abdullah think of the fact, you know, the Queen of England has been on the throne for, 60-odd years now, and her son hasn't yet had a chance to succeed her, you know, yeah. Okay, so Tosfos says, now let's make the calculation. Rabbi Akiva started married Rachel, the daughter of Kaval Savua, and started learning Torah when he's age 40. So even if their son is born right after that, so he's born when Rabbi Akiva is 40, 41 years old. Rabbi Akiva lived to 120. The Gemara tells us in Kiddushin, when Rabbi Akiva passed away, Rebbe was born. So in other words, Rebbe is 80 years, in other words, Rebbe is at most 80 years younger than Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. So what are you going to have then? Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha is, let's say, 140 years old already, and so Rebbe is 60, and he's telling him, you should live to half my life, you can live only another 10 years. What kind of a bracha is that? So therefore, Tosfos mentions another thing also. So Rabbi Natan, says in Tosfos, also he mentions Rabbi Nissim, says that no, when Ben Azai says Kereya Hazeh, he doesn't mean Rabbi Akiva, he means Rabbi Loz Ben Azariah. So in that case, the whole thing falls apart. So Rabbi Natan says, no, it's just his father's name was Korcha. Who was Korcha? We don't know, just like we don't know the names of a, just like we don't know about the names of a lot of the when he says
yeah.
It doesn't necessarily, according to Rabbeinu Nissim, it doesn't have to mean Rabbi Akiva.
And Rabbeinu Tam,
right? And Rabbeinu Tam, yeah, according to Rabbeinu Tam, HaKereya can well mean Rabbi Akiva, but it doesn't mean because of that his son is Rabbi Yeshua ben Tarva.
Right. Okay.
Now, there are a couple of others.
But there's a machlekes who that is in Bechiret.
Right, exactly. Now, with that said, though, there's a couple of other things that various Acharonim talk about this. First of all, there is actually, you know, in Ovestir of Nassim, it says that when Rabbi Akiva went to start learning Torah, he already had a son. He went together with his son to Cheder.
Oh, wow.
So that, what does that imply? Now, you're not going to have, it doesn't mean he married Rachel and then they're sitting around for a few years so he has a son who's old enough for Cheder, and then Eresh convinces him to learn Torah. Evidently, he had a previous marriage. His wife died or divorced, as the case may be, and he has a son from that marriage. And now, when he marries Rachel, he already has his, she adopts this kid, and now he's going, with his father to Cheder. So that kid could well have been this Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. So then in that case, it makes a little better sense. Why are they calling him ben Korcha? Because his father was not yet the famous Rabbi Akiva. His father is still some random bold guy, yeah. Which actually, in that...
It's
possible. In that case, that takes care of the chronological problem that Tosfos mentioned. There is also, you know...
The chronological problem is that he would be much older than...
No, yeah, because then he'd be much more than 80 years older than Rebbe. He could be 90 or 100 years older.
Yeah, 120.
Yeah, whatever. So, so then it may then it works out a little better.
200.
Yeah, whatever.
200
at the time. No, well, not quite that, but yeah, whatever. He could be like 160 or whatever, yeah. So I'll tell you, there's a Mishnah in Masechta Yedaya. No. Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, according to that, Rabbi Akiva, according to that, would be his actual father, his biological father. Rachel would be his foster mother. But I'll tell you also, it's interesting, there's a Mishnah in Masechta Yedaya that mentions a Rabbi Yochanan, the son of Yehoshua, the son of the father-in-law of Rabbi Akiva. I don't know whether that means that Rabbi Yochanan was the brother-in-law of Rabbi Akiva or whether it means that Yeshua was the brother-in-law of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yochanan his son. If you take it the first way, then it could very well be. So then in that case, the father-in-law of Rabbi Akiva is Yeshua. Now, we know his father-in-law is Kalba Sabur. So how is that? Kalba Sabur we know is a nickname for him.
Yeah.
So anybody who went into his house hungry as a dog came out satisfied. Mm-hmm. And years ago, actually, somebody pointed out to me online, Rav Tite from Elizabeth pointed out to me online that it could be Kalba Sabur's real name may have been Yehoshua. But I think maybe not. Maybe this Yehoshua that we're talking about and his son Yochanan is Rabbi Akiva's first father-in-law, if we say that he was married before he was married to Rachel. So in that case, he named his son after his father-in-law, as was very common in those days. You name the kid after the grandfather's fired him, do that out of Yemazet. So it could have...
After the father-in-law.
After Rabbi Akiva's father-in-law, who would be the kid's grandfather. Yeah. Fired him name after the living. No, they don't name after the father. They name after the grandfather because they name after the living.
Yeshua would be the first
father-in-law's name, and then he named his son Yeshua after his father-in-law. Eventually, when he starts going and learning Torah, then he takes along his son Yeshua with him, and they're sitting and learning Torah together. Derech Agav, by the way, I want to mention also in that connection this that was saying that he went with his son to learn Torah. There's another sefer called Medrash Agada. We're all familiar with the story of how all the kids have been learning it in connection with like Bomer, how Rabbi Akiva sees the water dripping and realizes Torah can penetrate my head. There's a much less well-known sequel to that in Medrash Agada. Okay, so Rabbi Akiva is convinced, fine, Torah can penetrate my head. But he goes to Rachel and he says, I have a problem though. So what, I'm going to be going and learning Torah together with my kid or together with the other little kids in Cheder? It'll be embarrassing that I'm a 40-year-old man sitting with a bunch of little kids in Cheder. So she does like this. She takes a donkey, and she spreads dirt on the back of the donkey and plants some vegetables in the dirt. Waits a couple of days, waters it, whatever. Pretty soon you have a garden growing on the donkey's back. One day she says to her husband, please take the donkey to the market. We need such and such. He goes, and of course everybody has a good laugh at him that you're planting a donkey on you're planting a garden on your donkey's back. The next day, the same thing. The third day, already he goes, and people, after a while, how many times can you ask the same thing? Everybody got used to it. So she says to him, same thing. Yes, you'll go to Cheder once, you'll be embarrassed. You'll go twice, you'll be embarrassed. You'll go three times, they'll be used to it already. And he took her advice to heart.
Wow.
So then, and then, so the continues over there. That, yeah, he's sitting over there, and he's sitting over there in cheder. He's holding one end of the little slate that the kids use to write their alephes on. His son is holding the other end, and they're starting literally with learning the alephes.
That's great. That's really great.
People don't know that he was maybe not even about
No, everybody agrees he was an Amor Eretz. He himself says on himself in Sochem that when I was an Amor Eretz, I used to say if only somebody would give me a Talmud Chacham and I'd bite him like a donkey. No, there's no question he was an Amor Eretz. He had certain good middos. Obviously, that's what Rachel saw in him in the first place. But,
what does
yeah.
it mean when you're Amor Eretz, you bite like a donkey?
It means, in other words, that he really hated the Chachamim. Yeah, he means he really hated the Chachamim. And the Gulf of Hama lording it over the people. You see, you have, for example, they have to be careful about Tumah Batara, so that created a certain social barrier between them and the Amei Aretz, whatever. So you had, there was, you know.
Why did he hate them?
But that's why, because he felt that they're lording it over, the Amei Aretz. Eventually, once he became a Talmid Chacham, he realized that's wrong, but he's describing how he felt back in those days. Okay. Anyway, let's get back to the Gemara. I'll tell you, by the way, I did see one other interesting explanation also, maybe where Rabbi Yeshua ben Korach got his name. Maybe during his lifetime he was tactical. For most of his lifetime, maybe he was known as Rabbi Yeshua, the son of Rabbi Akiva. But we know eventually Rabbi Akiva was arrested by the Romans. Maybe at that point Rabbi Yeshua Poshet had to change his father's name so they don't come after him. So everyone else was. I don't remember. I saw it someplace and I cannot remember where, but I What? No.
They must have known where he was.
No, but not necessarily. But for example, by the same logic, for example, you find, you know, we know Rabbi Akiva was very rich. You find Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, you find Gemara and Shabbos that he was very poor. He couldn't even afford shoes. If he was the son of Rabbi Akiva, where did all his father's machasim go? That could answer it also. If the Romans confiscated all of his property and Rabbi Yeshua himself had to run away and even change his name, then yeah. Okay. All right, let's get back to the Gemara. Okay, so we have Rabbi Bohu says in the name of Rabbi Yechanan, says in the name of Rabbi Yanai, says in the name of Rebbe, or Umotu Bar, or some say it's Meshmedi Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. Minayin Labal She'ena Noto Baroi Kav Mochzer. How do we know when a husband inherits from his wife, how do we know that he does not Yarshin from what is Roy, from what would be coming to her, Kav Mochzer, as he would inherit from what is in her possession right now? We're going to have the concept of Roy and Mochzer later on.
She inherits from her father?
No, in other words, like this. We're going to talk about Roy and Mochzer later in the parak in great detail, but in our case, it means like this. Let's say, for example, so a husband yarshins from his wife. Now, let's say when his wife dies, her father, let's say, is still alive. If her father had already died, she would have yarshin from him, and now her husband would be yarshining that. That would be called Mochzer. It's already in her possession at the time. What about before she died?
Before she died.
What about, though, if her father is still alive? So it's Roy in the sense that eventually she would have inherited it. Eventually she would have inherited it if her father had died first. But that's not Mochzer, that's Roy. That it would be coming to her eventually. She would be in line to inherit it, but she didn't actually inherit it yet at the time that she died. So how do we know the husband doesn't yarshin that?
Because you could argue
that maybe it's called Yodish Bekever, we're going to talk about as we go further along. It could be considered once her father died, at that point, effectively she yarshins him, but she can't because she's dead already. So therefore, it goes through her to her husband. How do we know that that's not the case? Now, we're going to have Roy and Mochzer later on in the Perek in connection with the Dinim of Bechor, and we're going to talk about over there the exact parameters of what's Roy and what's Mochzer. There is, in this case, Machlokes Rishonim, whether, for example, let's say she lent somebody money and that money hasn't been paid back yet. Is that called Mochzer because it was actually her money and she just lent it out? Or is it considered Roy because it hasn't actually been paid back at this point? Most of the Rishonim say it is considered Mochzer. There's a couple of the Rishonim, the Rambam included, who say that it's considered Roy.
But it's Mozak. Mozak is when you inherit.
But on the other hand, maybe not. The fact is it's not in her possession right now. It's been lent out. So you could argue with Mochzer because it did belong to her and she just lent it out. You could argue that it's Roy. Okay. Anyway, so how do we know, however we define Roy and Mochzer, how do we know a husband does not inherit from Roy? Shenema, this is the same passage we brought yesterday. It was Skuv Holodus Yor. We said Skuv fathered Yor by Heloi Esrim Beshalosh Orim Be'eretz HaGilad, and he, Yor, had 23 cities in the land of Gilad. So we have to ask, like we asked yesterday, Minayin L'Yor Shlohayla Skuv, how does Yor come to have property which didn't belong to his father's Skuv? So yesterday we said the reason was we would assume that Yor married a woman from that Shevet and then she passed away and he yarshed her. Here we're saying a different way of learning it. that Ela Malamach and not a Sgurvisha. Here we say that what it means is that we learn from it that Sgurv married, Umesa, married a woman, Umesa, B'chaye Morisheha. She died while the people she would have inherited from were still alive. Umesu Morisheha, and then the ones who she would inherit from, like her father, died, V'yosha Yair, and so Yair Yashin. In other words, so if we said the husband Yashin's from Ro'oi, so fine, she died, her father, who owned these 23 cities, is still alive, fine, so it doesn't go to Sgub yet, but eventually when the father dies, Sgub should be getting it. The fact that you see it bypassed Sgub and went straight to Yair shows that the husband does not inherit from Ro'oi like he inherits from Mul. And also you have the pasuk at the end of Yeshua, the Elazar ben Aaron met by Yifru Vagomer. The pasuk says that Elazar passed away and they buried him in the hill of Pinchas, his son. So we asked yesterday, Minayim Pinchas Shalahola Elazar, how does Pinchas come to have property that didn't belong to his father Elazar? Same thing, Malamash and after Elazar is Isha, it means that Elazar married a woman, Omeisa B'chayim Morisheha, she passed away while her father or whatever person she would have inherited from is still alive, Omeisa Morisheha, then that person passed away, V'yosha Pinchas, and then Pinchas yashined it, so again, it bypasses Elazar and goes straight to Pinchas. Okay. So the question is, why do we have to bring two psukim? Why can't we prove it from one pasuk? Because v'chitei yor to have a nasav itso meisav yosa. Because you could answer in the case, if you only have the first pasuk, you could say, like we explained it yesterday, that it's not that Sgur was married and then his wife died and then his father-in-law died. It could be that it had nothing to do with Sgur, but it had to do with Yor. It was Yor's wife who died and he yashin straight from her. So that's why the pasuk meant. That's why we also mentioned the one about Elazar. So you're going to ask, like we said yesterday, that how do we know? It didn't have to involve yarshining at all. Pinchas could have gotten this field from Sdecha Ramim, a field that somebody donated as cherem koyanim, which then goes straight to the koyanim. So Pinchas could have gotten it that way. Or we talked about yesterday that it could have been the Sdecha Chuzah, which goes in Yovel to the koyanim on duty over there. No, the reason is Omakra Bnoi, because the pasuk doesn't just say that he was buried in the hill of Pinchas. It adds the word Bnoi, his son. Now we know Pinchas is Elazar's son. The pasuk doesn't have to tell us over here. It means Nachla Ru'uyaloi v'Yosha Bnoi. This is a Nachla that in principle could have been Roy for him, but instead his son Yashin. Meaning, in other words, the Rashbam says that what happened over here, and actually the whole pasuk goes like this: there was an iron mess. Vayik Roy to give us Pinchas Benoi, Asher Nitan Loi Baharef Roy. That this hill belonged to Pinchas' son, which was given to him in Haref Roy. So we have two things over here. We have the word Benoi, which the pasuk doesn't need to tell us Pinchas is Elazar's son. We know that from the Torah. And number two, what's the Asher Nitan Loi that was given to him? The Rashbam explains what we darshan, in other words, is like this. We focus on that. We say what it means is this Nachla, in principle, could have gone to Elazar. Now, how could it? It wouldn't be the case if it belonged to Pinchas' wife, because then Elazar had nothing to do with it. It has to be it belonged to Elazar's wife. Or not it belonged to Elazar's wife, rather, but it was from Elazar's wife's family, rather. It was Roy. It was something that could conceivably have been yashin by her while she was alive, except that she passed away before the original owners of it did, before her father or whoever it was did. So what happened? They come to a din Torah. Elazar versus Pinchas come to a din Torah. Elazar is arguing, I should be able to inherit from Roy. This is Roy for my wife, because eventually when her father passes away, she would have yashin it from him, and then I should yashin it from her. It should be considered, we should have Yerusha Bakeder. And Pinchas argues that no, you're not, you don't yashin from Roy like you yashin from Musa. You yashin everything that was in her possession when she passed away, not anything that would have been in her possession later on. And the Beis Din Paskin, like Pinchas, and Hashem Nitan Loy, was given to him on the basis of that fact in.
How did they know that it was?
Because that's what we're proving. That's how we know the din.
No, but how did they paskin?
They paskin on the basis that they knew the halacha. They knew the halacha that the husband doesn't inherit from Roy Kibamuksa. And we have, how do we in later generations know that? Because we have these two psukim, one in the case of Yor and Sgur, and one in the case of Pinchas and Elazar. In the case of Pinchas and Elazar, we must say that it was like that, because otherwise the pasuk doesn't need to say that he's Benoi, and the pasuk doesn't need to tell us that it was Hashem Nitan Loi. So on that basis, we understand that it means that that was the situation. And once we do that, we can also understand that that's how it must have been by Yor and Sgur as well. Zvul was married, he would have yarshin it from his wife, except that it still belonged to her father at the time. Later on, when she died, it didn't go to Zvul, it went straight to their son Yair.
So the son comes before the father.
So the son comes before the father. That's exactly what we're saying. Which now, when we discussed this yesterday, we didn't bring up this point because there we weren't focusing on the word bnoi. We weren't focusing on the fact that Tosfos was saying by Pinchas that it's bnoi, that it's a nachla that could have belonged to him, but instead goes straight to his father. Now that we're focusing on that, then we see that, then we understand that that's how the pasuk gets explained.
But then you the halacha from where?
So then they knew the halacha because they learned it from Moshe Rabbeinu. I don't know. This is only, we're talking, Eliezer passed away, like we said yesterday, not long after Yeshua did. So you're talking, you're talking maybe 30 years that you're talking, Yeshua himself led the Jewish people for 28 years. So you're talking maybe 30 years after Moshe passed away. You have this Canaan Shabbatot who had learned that from Moshe. Maybe it was halacha of Moshe Mitzinai. Maybe it was whatever it was exactly. Yes. It was the known halacha, yeah. What?
They had Masada.
They had Masada, yeah. All right. Fine. So
where is it mentioned that?
What
the Din Torah?
The Din. That's what the Rashbam says. The Rashbam says the Rashbam mentions two explanations. One is that would be medayik from the word Hashem Nitan Lo that they gave it him on the basis of a Din Torah. Or the other explanation is we're medayik from the word Benoi. That this is something that could conceivably have gone to Eliezer, but instead it went straight to Pinchas. So therefore, it can't be Stecha Roman, because then the fact that Pinchas gets it has nothing to do, per se, with Eliezer. So if it's Benoi, it has to be. It had something to do with the fact that they're father and son. Okay. So that's the Maskana, therefore, is we have our various ways of learning that the husband inherits from his wife, but also this din that the husband only inherits Roy and not Mus. Only inherits Muchsuk and not Roy. Again, what the exact definition of Roy and Muchsuk is, in this connection, the Machlokas are showing him on the exact parameters. Onward. The Mishnah continues, Ubnei Ochos. We said that children of a sister, meaning in other words, your uncle on your mother's side passed away, and he doesn't have any children of his own, then you, the nephews, Yarshan. That's Bnei Ochos. That you're the children of the Nifter's sister.
The brothers of the
let's give names to this. You have Reuven and you have Dinah, brother and sister. Dinah has a daughter called Miriam. So if Reuven passes away childless, then the Nachla should go to the Nachla should go to his children, except he doesn't have any. It should go to his brothers, except he doesn't have any. So it goes to his sister, and from his sister it goes to the children.
The children.
Yeah.
To her children,
yeah. So Tana, we learn in a Braisa, Bnei Ochos Velez Bnei Ochos. This applies to the children to the sons of the sister, but not to the daughters of the sister. So the nephew is not the niece. The question is, Lamai Hilchsa. What do you mean? What do you mean? I mean, if Dina doesn't have sons, she only has daughters. Of course they're going to Yarshin. Why shouldn't they? The same way as they Yarshin from their own parents. Why shouldn't they Yarshin from their uncle? The daughter stands in place of her mother. We're going to say in the next Mishnah that the way it goes is each time when you're figuring out who the next Yodish is, you start by going down the tree over there until you find an heir. And if you don't find any, then you go up the tree and go to the previous generation, whatever. So obviously, obviously in this case, if Dina has sons, then they're going to Yarshin. If she doesn't have sons, then daughters are going to Yarshin. From Dina's brothers. Yes, from my Hilchsa. What exactly are we saying applies only to the sons, not the daughters? Amar Rav Sheshes Lekadim. So Rav Sheshes says, yeah, all it means is that they come first. That you shouldn't think, in other words, that since already you're talking about a later level Yerusha over here, you're not talking about a direct Yerusha, it's going from uncle to niece or nephew. You would think maybe the niece or the nephew inherit equally. No.
So only first to the son.
So only first to the son. And if there's no sons, then to the daughters. Right.
But the daughters are not excluded.
Right. Tanir of Shmuel Bar Avitcha Kameid Ravona. So Rav Shmuel Bar Avitcha teaches the Braise in front of Ravona. How do we know this? Because the pasuk says v'yorash. The pasuk finishes off when it says parashas Nachla is over there. It says you give it to the closest relative, v'yorash, and they should inherit. makish Yerusha Shnia le Yerusha Rishona, which means we're making a hekesh between the second Yerusha and the first Yerusha. Now, what is the first? What do we mean by the first Yerusha and the second Yerusha? The Rashbam says it means the first Yerusha means the son or the son or the daughter. The second Yerusha are the ones that are listed later on in the pasuk. If there's no son and there's no daughter, then you give it to, we said the other day, the father, and if not, then to the uncles, and if not, then the Moshe'er Akar of Elav. So those are called the Yerusha Rishona than in the first one. Yerusha Shnia are the later ones that are mentioned in the pasuk, or as far down as you need to go. So we're making a hekesh between them, especially because the Rashbam, between the original one, between the Yerusha that should go to the son or the daughter, versus the Yerusha that could go to the brother or the uncle or whatever. Ma Yerusha Rishona Ben Kodem Labas, just like in the first Yerusha, the pasuk clearly tells us, as we learned the other day, the son comes ahead of the daughter, after Yerusha Shnia, so it is, by all the later Yerushas, Ben Kodem Labas, that the son comes ahead of the daughter. So over here, that's what we're saying over here, that if the uncle passes away, and his sister is going to inherit him, except the sister already passed away, then it'll be her son's first to inherit, if she has any, and if not, then her daughter's. Tosfos has a different explanation of Yerusha Rishona and Yerusha Shnia. That Yerusha Rishona means the direct inheritance, and Yerusha Shnia means the indirect one. Like here, where you have, for example, that it's going to be a niece or a nephew or whatever Yarshining it. Which, how do they do that? They do that through their mother that you're going to have. She should be the Yerush, except since she's dead, then it goes down another generation and goes to her children. That's Yerusha Shnia. Either way, the point is, the pasuk is making a hekesh because each of these ones, when the pasuk lists it, it introduces it with a vav. V'im ein le'bas, then you give it to his brothers. V'im ein le'achim, then you give it to achayor. V'im ein achim le'aviv, then so the vavs tie it all together and say that the same rules that apply in the first one to the son or the daughter apply to all the other ones. According to the Rashbam, again, all the other ones that are mentioned later in the Pesukim. According to Tosfos, all the indirect ones that are not mentioned in the Pesukim at all, but which you get to them by going down the various nodes of the tree until you find the name.
Yeah.